Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Monday, December 7th. I'm Ray Graff. Support for Medical Monday comes from Saratoga Hospital and the hospital's minimally invasive gynecologic surgery program, led by doctors Anouk Lambers and Siobhan Hayden. SaratogaHospital.org to learn more. Joining us for Medical Monday is radiation oncologist Dr. Tia Olds of New York Oncology Hematology. If you have a question, give us a call early. 800-348-2551 is the number, 1-800-348-2551. You can email us as well, voxpop@wamc.org, and we'll get to as many email messages as we can. The number, once again, though, is 800-348-2551. Dr. Tia Olds and your oncology questions coming up on Vox Pop right after the news. Hello, once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Joining us today for Medical Monday is Dr. Tia Olds. Dr. Olds is a board-certified radiation oncologist at New York Oncology Hematology, treating all types of cancers. Dr. Olds received her bachelor's degree from Morris Brown College in Atlanta and received her medical degree from the Morehouse School of Medicine, where she was the class valedictorian, and completed her residency in radiation oncology at SUNY's Upstate Medical University in Syracuse. Dr. Olds currently treats patients at NYOH's Albany, Patroon Creek, and Clifton Park locations, and she has a passion for helping patients advocate for themselves and understanding their power in healthcare decision-making. The number here is 800-348-2551. If you have a question about oncology, 800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. That's voxpop@wamc.org. But the number, once again, is 800-348-2551. Dr. Tia Olds, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Ray. How are you?
Good. So nice to have you back on the line. I think you were with us in the, about a month ago, a month or two ago?
Something like that. Yeah, that sounds right.
Well, it's great to have you back. And it seems that before we get into what is appearing to be another surge of COVID-related shutdowns of elective surgeries and things like that, and hospitals getting jammed again, let's just talk a little bit about something I mentioned in your introduction. One of the things it says that you have a passion for is helping patients advocate for themselves. I wonder if you could explain that a little bit.
Oh, sure. Absolutely, Ray. I think it's always just devastating to receive any diagnosis or tentative diagnosis. And for a lot of people who maybe go and see their physician, their primary care provider, every 6 months or every 12 months, to be bombarded with a host of appointments and diagnostic tests and blood work, I think it's going to be overwhelming for most people. So I think there's some real value in having some direction in terms of organizing the information. And sometimes that's as simple as having a notebook where you're able to say, I went to Dr. Smith, and this is what she said. These are the things she recommended. And just kind of keeping a very simple log of what tests have been ordered, who's ordered them, and what appointments are forthcoming.
You know, you mentioned understanding the patient's power in the healthcare decision-making process. And I get your point, especially about things that aren't quite as important as cancer. But at some point, you have to put it in the hands of the doctor, right?
Oh, you're absolutely right about that. The providers that are there to help you certainly have input. But I think it's extremely important to understand that your decision at the end is the most important, and you have to go with the provider or providers whom you trust. That means having some faith in what they're advising you, and that goes beyond what you're reading on their resume and what you're seeing on their walls. You have to make that decision in whom you're going to trust your decisions.
That makes sense. We are joined today by Dr. Tia Olds of New York Oncology Hematology. If you have a question about oncology today, give us a call at 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Well, you know, I am sure that if those of us in the civilian world have a serious case of pandemic fatigue or whatever, rage, it must be tenfold among the medical community. Now, you've been not necessarily on the front lines of COVID-19, but you've been dealing with the ramifications of that and the added layers of security and testing and sanitizing that ordinarily would go with something like that. And I assume that most procedures that you guys do are not elective, correct?
That's correct.
All right, so that will not affect you. But I am also fairly certain, having done this myself over the last year, people sometimes would delay something, a test, or something that they may eventually need or they think they might need because of the pandemic. Have you been seeing more ramifications from that mindset?
I unfortunately have to say that we have in our offices, we've seen people after the first surge come in several months later, having had some diagnostic test delayed or perhaps a biopsy that was going to be performed but wasn't performed for a multitude of reasons. And now you have people getting diagnosed several months after the fact and really trying to play catch up with getting the care that they need started. So we have seen that.
It seems to me that, you know, as far as getting a jump on the timeline, treating cancer is pretty important to get a fast start. The faster you start, the better off you will be in the long run. Do you think down the road, a year, 2 years, 3 years, we will still be seeing the ramifications from this pandemic?
I think that's a real possibility. I think it's really difficult to know what opportunities are missed. Because whether or not we look at it, our lives are timelines in a sense. So one decision can affect, you know, hundreds down the road. So I do think the ramifications of what's happened over the last 6-8 months will be felt for some time.
Tia Olds joins us today. Dr. Tia Olds from New York Oncology Hematology. The number, if you have a question, is 800-348-2551 on this Medical Monday. We hear this all the time, and we're all becoming sort of armchair doctors in our own way or researchers because you're inundated with news about COVID-19 24/7 if you turn the TV or radio on. Studies indicate, of course, underlying health conditions, chronic respiratory problems, cardiovascular, diabetes, cancer, are people who have those are at a higher risk for dying of COVID-19. I guess a simple question is, what is it that is happening in a cancer patient's body that makes them at higher risk for serious COVID symptoms?
So just to make a generalization, you're looking at someone whose immunity has probably been decreased either because of the disease process, treatments, or both. So that in itself is going to make them more susceptible. If you're talking about someone who's been diagnosed with a respiratory type of cancer, their lung function may already be compromised. So you layer that on top of a malignancy, and then you layer COVID-19 on top of that. It's really a serious issue that can result in significant morbidity and mortality.
Does radiation therapy in general weaken an immune system?
So that's an excellent question, and it largely relates to what's being radiated. So if someone's getting a large portion of their bone marrow treated with radiation, that means that their blood counts could decrease as a consequence. So for instance, someone who's getting radiation to their pelvis for rectal cancer, their bone marrow is likely going to be affected by the radiation therapy, and it may be enough of an effect during the treatment that their blood counts are lowered. So that's something that's monitored during the process of treatment. So the answer is yes and no. It just depends on what's being radiated.
Now, you focus primarily on oncology and radiation oncology. Those who are more focused on chemo and things like that, are they seeing, when you give chemo to someone, the immune functions are really hit pretty bad, right?
They certainly can be, yes.
So radiation oncology has less of an effect unless you are focusing on certain areas, bone marrow being one of them.
That's correct.
Let's take a quick break here, and then we'll get to the phones. Phone lines are loading up. Still a couple of open lines. Dr. Tia Olds of New York Oncology Hematology joins us today, and we'd love to get your question in. 800-348-2551. We'll be right back. Oh, It's Vox Pop. It's Medical Monday. Ray Graff with you at 800-348-2551. If you have a question for Dr. Tia Olds, who joins us today from New York Oncology Hematology. And Dr. Olds, let's go right to the phones. Kathy in Schoharie County. Hello, Kathy. You there?
Yes, I am. Hi, Ray. Hi. Hi, Dr. Hi. Olds. Is it? My son was diagnosed with prostate cancer and was treated with radiation. And he keeps getting his PSA tests.
Yes.
And they're not decreasing the way one would hope. Would he be a candidate for more radiation, or would they just go to chemo?
So that's a good question. Do you know when he completed his radiation treatment?
I think it was before this past summer.
Okay. So there's some different definitions for what's considered a PSA failure after radiation therapy. So my guess is they're continuing to monitor that increase and may consider him for additional therapy based on that. That could certainly include chemotherapy, hormonal therapy, but it would largely just depend on what that increase is and his other potential comorbidities.
But no more radiation?
That is unlikely.
Unlikely. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Kathy, thanks a lot for the call. Number here is 800-348-2551. We're joined today by Dr. Tia Olds of New York Oncology Hematology. David in Williamstown. David, you're up.
Hello, Ray and Dr. Olds.
Hello.
My question has to do with what you may have heard out there, Dr. Olds, during the campaign, since we're coming up on the 50th anniversary of the declaration of the war on cancer, and the president that we now have was put in charge of the cancer moonshot back during the latter stages of the Obama administration. And I'd like to know, especially if we get a COVID vaccine that is worth its salt, if a similar effort could be done, if there's been any talk of this, to knock down some of the traditional obstructions, to give incentives and massive government support to finding a cure for cancer, similar to what we've done with COVID. And I'll leave it right there and see what you've heard. Thank you. I'm going to listen off air.
Thanks a lot, David. All right, Dr. Olds.
Well, that's a good question, and I don't have a specific answer for you. I have to say that with the pandemic kind of hitting the entire world the way that it has, I have not heard any updates on what we're doing in terms of the war to fight cancer in that regard.
You know, it strikes me that it's a fairly broad word, cancer. It covers a lot of ground. I mean, one size would not fit all on a cure, correct?
That is correct.
Let's go back to the phones at 800-348-2551. Mohammed in Niskayuna. Mohammed, you're on.
Good afternoon. I have a question. My wife was told that she has 7 months to live, and she's actually in her 9 months. Doctor, I have one ask you a question. Do you think I should get a second opinion, or... sometimes it takes whatever. Question number two was, the gentleman that asked you a question already, should we have some type of force from the government when it comes to cancer like we have them for a COVID-19 vaccine?
So I'll answer your first question first with another question. First of all, I'm glad your wife is still with us. What is her diagnosis, if I may ask?
Her hands start cripples. Her hands, actually her fingers, like almost going to her palm. There's no doctor actually can do something about it because all her nerves are dead. And she's not doing well at all. She can't get up. She's in a lot of pain. She's consistently in a lot of pain, days and nights, sleeping, whatever pills she takes. She's in pain a lot.
I'm sorry to hear that. Is she under any type of palliative care?
She is right now, currently speaking, under hospice cares.
Okay. So certainly a second opinion is something you can consider. I worry that her general health has declined to a point that I'm not sure that there would be something available that she could even tolerate if she declined that significantly.
Okay. All right, Mohammed, thank you for the call. The number is 800-348-2551. Dr. Tia Olds joins us today from New York Oncology Hematology. Getting back to David from Williamstown's question.
Yes.
Do you think there is enough money being put in to cancer research?
So I think I have a biased opinion about that. So I would certainly say no. And some of that has to do with all the things we think about in terms of how healthcare dollars are actually spent, how they're delineated for the different disease entities. And we know that there's some malignancies that receive a lot more funding than others. So you have that pool of resources being divided, that entire pool that really could stand increased funding. And then you have things that nobody could have seen coming in terms of where healthcare dollars are going, like what's happening currently with the pandemic. But I would have to say, yes, more money is needed for research in multiple cancer arenas.
What arena would you suggest should be the focus?
Oh, that's a good question. So I don't have a single arena because there are a multitude of different cancers. I mean, obviously, people are very familiar with breast cancer and lung cancer, but there are other cancers as well, colorectal cancer, multiple gastrointestinal cancers, pancreatic cancer, which certainly doesn't have the rate of incidence that lung cancer and breast cancer and prostate cancer have, but the mortality rates are significant. So having money go into the different types of malignancies for further research is invaluable. And that takes a group of professionals and other people in healthcare to kind of decide where those dollars should go.
It makes sense. Dr. Tia Olds joins us today. And you look at what competition did and in apparently successful way, generating multiple COVID-19 vaccines in an incredibly short amount of time. If money was no object, and again, they've been researching cancer. Doctors and researchers have been looking at this for decades and decades now. But if money was no object, could something similar happen along a fast timeline for cancer?
So that's an excellent question. I don't know that it would be that simple. Not that the COVID pandemic has been simple, nor the coming together with actually coming up vaccines. That has not been anything close to easy. The difficulty with cancer, something you alluded to earlier, Ray, is that this isn't one single disease. It's a multitude of diseases, that continue to change, that continue to adapt to factors that we don't necessarily even understand. So that makes it a moving target, a constantly moving target. And there's been talk about mutation of the coronavirus, which we know happens. There's some real thinking that the virulence of the coronavirus, for instance, continues to decrease with time, meaning that you're having more people that may be affected by it, but perhaps the mortality rates will decline. That's complexity without question. Now think about that from a standpoint of cancer that affects multiple organs, multiple body parts, and affects different people differently. It just is a much more complicated situation.
Dr. Tia Olds joins us today on this Medical Monday. Dr. Olds is a board-certified radiation oncologist at New York Oncology Hematology. Let's jump back to the phones at 800-348-2551. Jim in Matamoros, Pennsylvania. Jim, you're on.
Is radiation less effective against fibrosarcoma or sarcomas in general?
Less effective compared to, like, chemotherapy? Is that what you mean?
A chondrosarcoma or osteogenic.
Sarcomas, particularly those two subtypes, tend to require a larger dose of radiation. Generally, surgery is something that is the mainstay for initial treatment. But radiation is certainly used in different circumstances. But those sarcomas in particular do take larger doses of radiation.
Jim, thank you for the call. The number here is 800-348-2551. If you have a question for Dr. Tia Olds on this Medical Monday, Diana in Montgomery, you're on.
Hello. thank you.
Sure.
Dr., I have salivary gland cancer, and the gland was removed last month. I have been to a radiation oncologist, and I just didn't like the way it sounded. I'm 92 years old. This is supposed to be a rare cancer. It's an adenoid cystic carcinoma, mm-hmm. and it's a recurrent one. Now, between the fact that I'm 92 years old, this thing is going to come back anyway. I'm of the mind that I shouldn't do radiation. I've read all the after effects. None of them sound good.
Have you seen the radiation oncologist already to have that discussion?
Yeah, but I wasn't satisfied, so I'm going to see another one, and I'm going to speak to a medical oncologist.
I think you're headed in the right direction to get a second opinion. Sometimes we just don't necessarily connect with one another, and maybe speaking to someone else will be helpful for you.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's mm-hmm. worthwhile.
Okay.
Oh, right. You can't give me an opinion, I guess.
It'd be tough to do that
over
the phone.
Not without having more information. Those are fairly uncommon. Tumors, salivary gland tumors themselves aren't particularly common. I've seen a handful probably of adenoid cystic carcinomas. I think it's well worth mm-hmm. having the discussion. You are 92, but if you can improve your function and longevity, I think that's worthwhile considering.
Diana, thank you for the call. Our number is 800-348-2551. Our guest today is Dr. Tia Olds from New York Oncology Hematology. Ellen is in Queensbury. Ellen, you're on.
Hi. So I have a question that is mostly about breast cancer. So with regard to advocating for yourself, when it comes to breast cancer, we are encouraged to go get mammograms, and that is one of the ways that you might possibly increase your incidence of breast cancer. So one, is there any way to deal with that? And two, from a personal standpoint, I have breast cancer in my family, so I'm less interested in getting mammograms and wondering whether there's some way you can advocate for ultrasound or something like that.
Over the last, I would hate to get the range incorrect, but I would say for the last 10, 15 years, there's been a real drive, a real effort to decrease the amount of radiation that's used during diagnostic testing, including mammograms. So I would say that getting a mammogram at this point involves using low-dose radiation, so you're not getting the amount of radiation that should significantly increase your risk of developing breast cancer as a consequence. There are obviously exceptions out there. People who have known genetic disorders that are more susceptible to ionizing radiation, but I don't think that applies to you based on what you've said so far. I think mammography is still going to be considered the gold standard for screening purposes, and sometimes ultrasonography complements that. I don't think you're going to find a clinician that's comfortable sending you for an ultrasound only and not getting the mammogram. With regard to family history, you may want to speak to your oncologist to see if there's a role for hereditary cancer risk assessment. If there is a family history, is there a chance that you have a genetic predisposition to develop breast cancer and ovarian cancer? So that may be a discussion you want to have.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Ellen, thank you for the call. Dr. Tia Olds joins us. This email from Emily. Emily writes, a surgeon recently told me that if a woman is treated for breast cancer by having a lumpectomy and radiation therapy and the cancer reoccurs, she will not be able to have radiation therapy a second time. I also just heard you tell a caller that more radiation therapy for a patient with prostate cancer who had already had this treatment was unlikely. Can you please tell us why radiation therapy cannot be, or rarely is, repeated for one patient? And that is from Emily.
Excellent question. So it largely depends on what area has been radiated. Generally, if someone's gotten whole breast radiation following a lumpectomy, generally it's not thought that adding additional radiation is something that's pursued, but there are exceptions to that statement. So in certain instances, re-irradiation is something that can be pursued to the breast. The standard is to actually undergo a mastectomy, though. That still remains the standard for breast recurrence when it recurs in the breast itself. For those that would actually benefit from additional radiation, the treatment is slightly different in terms of the amount of radiation that's administered. It is also a different schedule, meaning that you generally are getting two treatments a day separated by about 6 hours, because there's a real concern that you can develop significant side effects because you are re-irradiating a tissue that's gotten a significant dose. When it comes to prostate re-irradiation, that's more tricky because the dose that has been delivered to that area is high. It's a high dose. So now you're concerned about perhaps damaging the bladder, which is very close to the prostate, damaging the rectum, which is also very close. Those things have known radiation toxicity limits. And to consider re-irradiating them is a significant risk.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. We're joined by Dr. Tia Olds today of New York Oncology Hematology. You mentioned side effects, specifically in this case, with regard to having more doses of radiation. What sort of side effects are we talking about here? More cancer?
So in terms of side effects, when we're talking about the pelvis and prostate retreatment, you run the risk of damaging the bladder.
In what way?
Changing the bladder. Oh, yeah, good point. I'm getting there, Ray.
Okay, well, I'm sorry.
No, I'm kidding. Having the bladder not function normally. So having difficulty with continence, meaning that you don't have the ability to control urine flow. Sometimes having difficulty emptying the bladder completely, meaning that you've changed the muscle fibers enough that you don't get that muscular contraction that you need. Rectal changes can include bleeding, can include actually developing abnormal connections between the bowel and the bladder. And I'm giving you the extreme late consequences of these things because they don't happen very often, thankfully. But those are some of the potential complications that you can run into by re-irradiating someone in the pelvis.
But what exactly is the radiation doing? Is it hardening the fibers? Is it burning them? What exactly is the damage?
So you're coming into an area that's already received radiation, so you've developed some scar tissue as a consequence of that. Normal tissues have developed scar tissue as a consequence of that. So now you've altered that environment. You've changed the blood supply. You've created scar tissue, which you can almost think is kind of like a tough burlap in an area that was normally a lot more supple and soft, which means those areas can be easily torn and damaged by normal body processes.
All right. You know, let's pick that up on the other side of the break. We'll take a quick break here. Dr. Tia Olds is our guest today. From New York Oncology Hematology, the number is 800-348-2551. If you have a question, you can also email us, voxpop@wamc.org. We'll be right back. Vox Pop, it's Medical Monday. Dr. Tia Olds joins us today from New York Oncology Hematology. The number to call is 800-348-2551 if you have a question. And quickly, before we get back to the phones, the dosage, if you will, the power of the radiation that is given is different for each kind of cancer and each organ, correct?
That's correct.
Has the overall power, no, not the power, the power of the beam, let's just say, the radiation beam, in general, is it higher now than it was, or is it lower than in the early days of oncology, radiation oncology?
So that's a tricky question. So most of the radiation that we talk about and is utilized is external beam radiation, meaning that the beam is external to your body and it's directed almost like a flashlight going to the place where you want it to go. So I would say 30 years ago and further back, we didn't use linear accelerators at that point. There were cobalt machines that were utilized, which actually had a radioactive source within the machine, and that's how folks were treated. So those beams tended to have more in the way of low-energy X-rays, which caused more skin reactions. So when you compare someone treated in that era to now, there is a difference in terms of those skin changes and scar tissue changes and the like. So while the doses may have been the same, the quality of the radiation is different.
Interesting. So X-rays are a lower frequency or a lower energy level than what you use now, which is what?
Oh, no, they're both X-rays in a sense. So when you had the radioactive source being used, the cobalt-60 being used, those were emitting radiation the same way that you have a linear accelerator. It was just the quality of it. Because this was an actual source of radiation, there was really no way to get rid of some of those lower energies that were also being produced. When you have a linear accelerator, you're actually speeding electrons down a path that then come into contact with metal. And from there, you have generation of X-rays, and those are then directed to the target. So because of that, you're actually able to specify the beam energies that you want.
So interesting that X-rays can be energized in different ways to do different things. This is something I got to come down and check out the shop and see how you do things. Let's go to
come on down, Ray. You let me know.
Let's go to Ecole in Hudson. You're on. Hello.
Oh, I was just calling. Hello.
Hello. You're on.
Hello.
I was just calling. A woman just called to ask if there was an alternative to mammograms. And there definitely is. It's called a thermogram. And I do them every year. And they're as reliable, if not more reliable, than a mammogram. And you don't have any radiation. And you don't have to go through what you have to do with the mammogram.
Doctor.
So I have to tell you, I don't have a lot of it. Oh, sorry. Sorry, were you done?
Yes, thank you very much.
Oh, all right.
Go ahead.
So thermograms use infrared technology. So I don't have experience with those. But in terms of what is still recommended by the American Cancer Society and other organizations who kind of set forth the guidelines for screening, thermograms are not considered to be a substitute for mammography. And I can't get into the specifics, not because I don't want to share them with you, but because I don't know what they are. Mm-hmm. But I know that that is not considered a replacement for mammography. And that's not to say there's not a role. I don't know what that role is. So I think they are, actually.
Yeah. And in many countries, excuse me for interrupting you, but they don't even allow mammograms in some countries now. And thermograms are widely accepted.
Okay.
So I just think it's only fair for this dear woman who doesn't want to be subjected to radiation, that she can at least have a thermogram and have a reading. And then if something comes up, then maybe she would have a mammogram. But it's a good way to start without having to have a mammogram.
So I guess the only thing I would say to that is that if we're using infrared technology, which is what thermography is based on, that is radiation. So I think we're getting into semantics that may not make a difference. In terms of quality and energy, I think they're going to be lower energy, but that is not to say that it's not radiation. And if it's radiation by definition, you're going to have an increase potentially of developing consequences because of that.
All right. Well, they called. Thank you for the call. Our number is 800-348-2551. Dr. Tia Olds is our guest today. I'm still trying to wrap my mind around the fact that lower energy x-rays cause more damage to skin than higher energy. I'm trying to figure that out. Again, I'm going to come down to the shop and you're going to show me.
Well, you know what? I can give you an example of how that happens.
Yeah.
So when you go to the dental office and you're getting panoramics or you're getting dental x-rays and they put that nice little film in your mouth, which I find extremely hard to hold there.
Yes.
They put the emitter right next to your cheek. They cover you in a nice heavy lead shield to protect your thyroid, breast tissue, and nether regions.
Yep.
The reason they do that is because those are low-energy x-rays that bounce around like ping-pong balls. The emitter needs to be very close to that film in your teeth, otherwise it'll never reach the film, right? They'll go everywhere else.
Yeah. What? I've learned something. You know what? Thank you, Dr. Olds. Let's go to Ron in New Paltz. Ron, you're on.
Hello, doctor. How are you?
Good, sir. How are you?
I'm well. I have a question about T-cell lymphoma that is only presenting on the skin, mostly from the waist down and more particularly to just the leg. I'm calling because my dad is going through this right now. He is undergoing chemo, and most recently they are now going after the site-specific areas on the leg with radiation.
Yes.
And up till the point of doing radiation, he was having complications with infection on the leg, not brought on by the side effects of chemo.
Mm-hmm.
But they're trying to keep the infection in check. So I'm sorry this is long-winded. He's also qualified for a genome test, a Foundation One genome test. So kind of knowing a little bit about what I just told you, and I only know what I know from trying to get smarter each day about this. It sounds like T-cell lymphoma is a blood cancer, and although it hasn't showed up anywhere in the body other than presenting on the skin, what's your take on this whole thing? It sounds like it's extremely rare.
It is not super common, and I'm going to be a little bit general with that because it's more of a hematology oncology question. But when you have just a cutaneous or skin manifestation of a T-cell lymphoma, it tends to be problematic. And depending on the involvement, systemic treatments are indicated. And if you have areas that just don't seem responsive to the systemic therapy, or like you said, you're running into areas that are not healing and getting infected, radiation can be very effective in helping to dry up those lesions and get rid of them. Part of the reason why your father's getting infections in those areas, and I'm, again, making a generalization, is that because lymphoma is there, you have kind of an open area. You know, the skin's integrity is compromised. It won't heal because you have that malignancy there. So it allows for the possibility of superinfections, just the infections kind of taking advantage of a open area. So it becomes very difficult to treat because you have a T-cell lymphoma that is also likely impairing your ability for your immune system to fight off these infections. So it's kind of a double whammy.
Understood. There seemed to have been just a little bit of a misstep between, he was going to see wound care once a week and they were treating the site right at the surface and, you know, kind of wiping it down or I should say scraping it down. And as soon as he got on board with radiation treatment, they said, don't do that anymore. We want to let this area kind of regenerate on its own and we'll hit it with radiation. And I can't tell you the difference between someone, excuse the way I'm going to say it, messing with it weekly as to the radiation treatment has been extremely effective. And I guess I'm just making a generalization of it almost appears as figure it out as you go.
And it's sometimes it is that way. You just may have some difficulties in terms of understanding the diagnosis and what's necessary, good intentions being in place. there may have been, as you said, a bit of a miscommunication in terms of what would be helpful versus what was short-term kind of solution to an area that may have been really oozy and unpleasant.
All right, Ron, we got to move it along here, but thank you for the call. The number is 800-348-2551. Dr. Tia Olds is our guest. Somebody mentioned infrared earlier, and we've talked a lot about x-rays. Do you use gamma rays at all?
Ha-ha. So, yes, but not as much as we used to. So gamma rays are mostly relegated to a device called a gamma knife, which actually does use cobalt-60, which generates gamma rays. Mm-hmm. So, yes, it's used. It's just not used in the way that it has been in the past.
Why?
Utility-wise, for the reason we talked about earlier with those earlier linear accelerators, for people that have been treated with gamma knife, which is a radio surgery type of application, meaning you're directing beams of radiation to a very small area, giving it a large amount of dose, which can be very effective for certain tumors above the skull base. So it has limited application because of that.
But if it's more precise and you're focusing it on the area that is sick, shouldn't that be more in use? Or am I missing something there? Probably.
Oh, that was probably because I'm not sharing it with you. So gamma knife has utility for very small areas of involvement, and it's confined to the head. So you're talking about a small amount of penetration, and you're also talking about using lots and lots of small beams directed at that very small area that doesn't actually have to travel that far.
Okay. Dr. Tia Olds is our guest, and let's go back to the phones. Dave in Saratoga. Dave, you're on.
Hi. I just had a question. I'm on my third round with Fluoracil cream for my face for pre-cancer, and I'm wondering how safe that is to keep using on my face.
I don't know the answer to that. I think, is your dermatologist prescribing that for you?
Yes.
Okay. So I think you probably want to refer that question to them. These are, in fact, precancerous lesions. So my guess is that they want to use that so they don't have to keep going in and removing more and more tissue. But I would think that there is a plan in place because I don't think that would be used indefinitely. But I think that's a question you may want to ask. You know, what is the timeline for my usage for this and what are the next steps?
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, Dave.
You're welcome. Good luck.
Let's go to Elizabeth in Saugerties. Elizabeth, you're on.
Hello. Wow. Yes, I want to say I have radiation enteritis for radiation which took place in 1988. And I've had side effects from it ever since. Yeah. And the doctors have never told me anything I could do about it except take Imodium. Is there anything else?
What area of your body was treated?
Oh, colorectal cancer.
Okay. So if you're taking Imodium, I assume that's because you have lots of diarrhea. Have you undergone scope tests? Yeah. Have you undergone any colonoscopies or upper endoscopies?
Oh, yes. I've had quite a lot of them.
Okay. All right. Did they ever do any cauterization of any vascular areas? Was that something that was ever done?
No.
Okay. So, it's a little hard for me to be able to give you something direct. How often are you getting scoped?
I think it's every 5 years, but I'm 89 now, so I thought that maybe I just had my last one. I'm not going to do it again.
Oh. I don't know what else to potentially benefit you other than the Imodium. I would assume, and maybe I shouldn't assume, have you tried any probiotic therapies to see if those help?
I tried it once, and it didn't have any effect.
So that may be something you want to consider.
Again?
Maybe, and you may even want to check in with your gastroenterologist. He or she may have some specific strains that may benefit you more than others. Because, you know, probiotics, you know, are different strains of bacteria that are helpful to your, you know, the colon itself and the intestines. So there may be something specific that they may want you to try, but I think your answer may be there. Because if there was something more actionable going on, you would have scopes a little bit more frequently. So I would double back, circle back around with them to see if they have some thoughts as to what maybe to try next,
Elizabeth,
in the probiotic arena.
Thank you, Elizabeth, for the call. And let's quickly go over to Red Hook. And Mary, you're on.
Hi. Thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
Hi. I had lung cancer, and they did a lobectomy. And I went through radiation and chemo. The radiation was done with a Linarc. And part of the problem is that the one point was my thyroid. My thyroid got hit. So now I got a thyroid problem. So is there any way to fix this thyroid problem? Because I've always been, I'm 61 now. I have always been 115. Now I have plateaued in the 140s.
And so is the 140 and the 115, is that your TSH level? Is that what you're referring to?
No, that was my weight my whole life.
Oh, sorry. Okay.
Gotcha.
There you go.
Weight has... So yeah. I'm assuming that your cancer must have been in the upper part. What's that?
What'd you say, Mary?
Stretchy pants.
All right, fair enough. All right, doctor, we got about 45 seconds here. Go ahead.
All right, I'll speed it up for you. So I'm assuming the lung cancer is probably in the top part of the lung, which is why the thyroid may have gotten some dose. Hypothyroidism, right, meaning you have a low level, is very, very common. And the way to correct that is with medication. And it tends to be a chronic issue, unfortunately.
So there's no chance that there's no food that you can eat or anything that will fix this issue?
Unlikely, but sometimes your endocrinologist will have specific dietary changes that you can engage upon that can help kind of balance some of those things out. So that's a discussion to have with your endocrinologist. But keep the stretchy pants because they're just comfy.
Well, Mary, thank you for the call. And Dr. Tia Olds, thank you as always for joining us today. We're about done here.
All right. Thank you, Ray. I appreciate it.
We'll talk to you soon. Support comes from Saratoga Hospital, introducing Mako Robotic Arm Assisted Surgery, the latest joint replacement technology at Saratoga Hospital, saratogahospital.org, to learn more. Well, once again, thanks to Dr. Tia Olds of New York Oncology Hematology for joining us today. Thank you for listening. Thanks for the calls. Apologies if we did not get to your call. We'll do the topic again. Don't worry. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Phones answered by Joe Makowitz. Our producer's Jackie Orchard. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, we switch gears in quite a large way, and we go to a Vox Pop favorite, Rich Guthrie, who will talk to you about birds. Yes, you go from cancer to birds in 24 hours here on Vox Pop. And that's tomorrow at 2. Right now, stand by for the Media Project.